chapter 17. Everybody's favorite Sunday school lesson. David and Goliath. It's everybody's favorite Sunday school lesson until it becomes you and your deliverance. And it's a lot more fun to read about it than to live it. But God's going to find out who David is. And he's going to find out who Eliezer is, who later on in 2 Samuel stood his ground and defeated the enemy. He's going to find out who Jonathan is. God is going to put you in the environment that's going to expose who the men of Israel are that run, who the Sauls are that are greatly afraid, have no power with God, and who the Davids are that have God's anointing. Goliath is nothing more than an opportunity for God's anointed to arise to the top and to become victorious. Some people think Goliath is a problem. I think Goliath's an opportunity. Goliath is going to separate those from those who have it and those who ain't. Verse 35. A lion and a bear. Do you know that former victories build faith for future victories? It might be nice to not have to start with Goliath. It might have been nice to start with the lion and bear and to have established a pattern of victory and become confident in faith, knowing that God is with you. If you have victory over one demon, you'll get victory over two. You'll get victory over all of them. It's all the same principles, the same God, the same decision and dying to self on your part. If you can die to self once, you can do it again. If you were willing one time, you can be willing again. Even though it's another area and it might be difficult and it might be the worst one. Everyone's the worst one till you get through it. Thy servant slew both the lion and the bear, and this Philistine will be like one of them. David needed a supernatural endowment of power from God to slay the bear and the lion. And David knew it. He knew it was by the Spirit of the Lord. If you can do a little miracle, you can do a big miracle. God can, you know, he's not limited. Verse 37, the Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear, he'll deliver me from this Philistine. Saul said to David, go and the Lord be with thee. I don't think Saul had a whole lot of confidence in David. But Saul was at a place where he was willing to try anything. He's willing to go to Mexico and try Laetril. You know, when you're dying of cancer, you'll try it. Even if it isn't approved in the USA. Brother, you'll try it. You'll go to Europe and try some of their treatments that are maybe still in the experimental stage. And when you're desperate for God, you'll try faith. Some people seem to put that off to the very end. They seem to put off, you know, sinners put off Christ to the very end. Some Christians put off the cross to the very end. But you're going to die anyway. You might as well go to the cross. I talked to a brother that was on the verge of suicide one time. And I said, brother, if you're going to throw your life away, go to the cross. If you haven't got anything to live for, then don't live for anything except Jesus. Give him your life. Totally surrender. Why, if you're at such a stage of hopelessness that you haven't got anything in life to live for, praise the Lord. You haven't got any idols in your life, have you? There's nothing between you and God now. There's nothing left. You're at the place of the greatest opportunity yet. You're stripped. You're down in the prison house. Live every day the rest of your life for the Lord. Totally give him all. This brother didn't do it. He didn't do it. He decided he wouldn't commit suicide, but he'd hold on to selfishness and a few other things. And he's continued to make a mess of his life. But in that hour, he could have really made a commitment, and it would have really done something in his life. Now, David had a testimony of God's power. Saul armed David with his armor, and he put a helmet of brass upon his head. Also, he armed him with a coat of mail. Now, Saul's armor was probably metal armor. Oftentimes, they use leather armor. Metal armor was hard to come by in this date of history. And it was not chain mail anyway. It was that was a European invention. It was scales, leaves of metal overlaying each other, like a fish. Now, some have said, how did he arm him with his own armor? I thought Saul was so big, David would never get into that armor. Now, let's use our intelligence. Saul was trying to give David every advantage that he possibly could in the battle. So you know Saul is not going to put on some huge armor on David that drug on the ground and had no and it was a total... See, Saul was a military man. They have all kinds of armor all over the land. They have men that are professionals at making armor. They made lightweight armor made out of leather, like a saddle. It could turn a sword. Sure, maybe not 1,000 times, but you repaired your armor after the day's battle. And this armor was fastened together by straps, and they could adjust it. You know, it's like football gear. You tie it on and loosen it up, tighten it up. I mean, it has certain flexibility and so forth. There's no way Saul put armor on David that would be a detriment to him in the battle. Saul put armor on him that would be a help to him, even his own armor. Now, some of Saul's armor may not have fit David. I don't think Saul put that on him, because that's stupidity. Listen, Saul is the natural man all the way. So give Saul credit for doing the ultimate that the natural man could do, not just dumb things. Part of Saul's armor did fit David, because it was adjustable. Plus, it was metal. Oftentimes brass, which was like steel in those days. And that would be an advantage to David. David needed that in Saul's, you know, way of thinking. Saul's going into this metal against metal. See, metal against metal. You can't go up there with just a shirt on. Why, he'll wipe you out. Now, there's a few things that Saul doesn't think about. The head of Goliath's spear weighs 18 pounds. His sword, let me say that no matter what kind of armor David's wearing, one whap with that stuff, and he's going to be jolted about 10 feet off the ground. Saul's armor wouldn't help David at all. You know, it's like the guy that he went hunting with this gun they invented that shot these goos, these eggs, with a sticky goo. And the idea was you hit the animal in the face and it blinds them so that you can tie them up. And the people that were with him said, what happens if you miss? Yeah, what happens if you miss? And he says, and they're going to go hunt a lion. He says, what happens if you miss? And he says, the same thing that happens if I miss with a cannon. Friend, if you miss, you're dead. It doesn't matter what you're firing at that lion. In this case, it doesn't matter what kind of armor David wears against Goliath. It just isn't going to do any good. Even a helmet of brass on his head, all Goliath has to do is take his 18-pound skull crusher and go, knock, I dub thee. Listen, if you've ever swung an 8-pound maul, you can appreciate an 18-pound sword head. I don't care what kind of helmet he has. It's going to crunch his head down about his stomach. In other words, against the devil, you can come up with no human armor that is really going to do anything at all. David with a shirt on is just as effectively armed as with this brass armor on. Because it's really meaningless against Goliath. Just the sheer strength and weight of Goliath will flatten him and knock him unconscious, helmet or no helmet. Probably break his neck anyway. And wearing body armor against a sword or a spear like that, it's going to break his ribs anyway. It's going to knock the wind out of him anyway. It's going to knock him down. Just because it may turn the sword one time, man, when you're hit with a sword like that, you're a goner. So this stuff is meaningless. But see, in Saul's mind, it's steel against steel, sword against sword. As long as you're in that mentality, you know, argument against argument, you know, tit for tat, fight him back, friend, you'll never defeat the devil. That's the type of armaments we have had against the devil. The devil comes against us with anger, and what do we manifest back? See, these are demon spirits that you're fighting. These are Goliaths. I want you to know that the only type of weapon that will defeat these type of demons is love, the truth of God's word. I mean, we have got to have spiritual weapons or we're not going to win. You will not win against these kind of things. Jesus said, "He that taketh up the sword shall die by the sword." And that can represent human armament, human means. A sword swung by a human hand. That, you're going to die by it. It's just not going to deliver you. Now, Saul represents the natural man, and he wants to arm the spiritual man with the best the natural man has to offer. David girded his sword upon his armor. He essayed to go. That is, he attempted to go. But he did not, for he had not proved it. He wasn't used to Saul's armor. Now, some people say, well, he didn't wear Saul's armor because it was too big and cumbersome. And I say, that's not the answer. Saul fitted him to the max. He was ready. In Saul's mind, this was the best they could come up with. But to David, a man after the Spirit, fleshly, carnal battle implements are not comfortable. See, if you have been overcoming the devil by faith and obedience, by the Spirit of the Lord, and you get into a Goliath-type situation, this is no time to start leaning on the flesh. This is no time to change your weaponry. The weaponry in Ephesians is faith, the gospel, truth, the sword of the Spirit. See, that's the weaponry in Ephesians. And don't forget verse 19, praying with all prayer and supplication. A lot of people have forgotten that one. Praying with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit. Now, David was not used to this type of armor. And actually, with what David planned, going down there with a sling, this armor was really ineffective. See, the armor is to protect you from arrows, a sword, a spear, and that kind of thing. David never planned that any of that would even get near him. He never planned to get more than 5-10 feet from Goliath. He never planned to face him, really, hand to hand. He was going to get about 10 or 15 feet from him and shoot him down with a sling. And in that case, he doesn't need armor. What he needs is no armor, so he can be real quick afoot, and he can dodge whatever Goliath decides to throw at him. Goliath may be 9 feet 9, but he isn't going to shoot the 100-yard dash in 10 flat. David will be faster. He will be quicker. He'll be able to dodge and, you know, that kind of thing. David said, "I cannot go with these." The spirit man cannot go with Saul's armor. It's just never going to work. I have not proved them. I've never used this stuff. David put them off him. Now, this does not mean that David never wore armor as a warrior the rest of his life. I happen to know that he did. He was king. He wore the best armor in battle. But to fight Goliath, in this typological picture, the armor was a detriment to him. It was a hindrance. It was not at all a help. Now, the reason people think David couldn't wear Saul's armor is because they're still thinking of middle-aged boiler pants. That's not what Saul was wearing, a suit of boiler pants. This was flexible armor that was adjustable. Verse 40, he took his staff in his hand, chosen 5 smooth stones out of the brook, put them in a shepherd's bag, which he had, even in a scrip. His sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. Now, this sling is not human means either. It doesn't represent human means. It represents something that you put in God's hand, that in God's hand becomes mighty. Now, this sling, in and of itself, will not drop Goliath. Goliath is heavily armed, and all Goliath has to do is wear a shield or hold up his spear, wear a helmet with a nose bridge, or hold up his shield, and you can clink those stones off of him all day long. Now, in Israel, they did get really good with the sling. They got good with the sling like kids today get good with the basketball. They use these things all the time. I made one of these things one time with about a 5-foot, string on it. And I could not shoot that thing further than I could throw with my arm. But I took it down to the beach where there wasn't a house within 100 yards. And I could launch it any direction I aimed, but I couldn't hit a stump with it. I would have had to really work at it to hit a stump. But I could launch a pretty good size rock, size of a golf ball easily, quite a distance out in the water. And that was just my first time. And a homemade one, I didn't even know if mine was as good as theirs or whatever. But they got pretty good with these things. I'm sure that David could hit an orange, at 50 feet. I know he was a good shot, but still, that isn't enough. If you think this was just luck, or David outwitting Goliath, human means, there's a lot more to it than that. All Goliath has to do is hold his shield up every time David shoots one. I mean, you can see when a person's going to shoot you with those things. I mean, you can't sneak a shot off. Part of Goliath's downfall was he underestimated David. He thought, man, you're coming down here with a stone. You shoot me with stones. Goliath underestimated. But I know that God added about triple velocity to that rock and zeroed it right in on his forehead, right between the eyes and the bridge of the nose. The Philistines came on and drew near to David, and that man that bare the shield went before him. When the Philistine looked about, he saw David. He disdained him. Satan will always disdain those that are walking in the Spirit of the Lord. He was but a youth. It doesn't mean 12 years old. I think he's about 17 to 18. Ruddy, of a fair countenance. The Philistine said unto David, am I a dog that thou comest to me with staves? Well, David had a staff and a sling. That's what you do with dogs. Beat them off of the staff, shoot them with a rock. Dogs in Bible days were not pets, beloved. Dogs were packs of roaming scavengers that hindered their flocks, stole their poultry and other things. Dogs were to them like coyotes, you'd be driven off. The Philistine cursed David by his gods. The Philistine said to David, come to me, and I will give thy flesh unto the fowls of the air and to the beasts of the field. Well, David was mocked by his eldest brother. Saul said, you can't do it. That's the religious leaders of the day who are bound by unbelief. And then Goliath said, I'm going to feed your flesh to the fowls of the air. David didn't have a lot of encouraging words, did he? There weren't a lot of people pumping him up in faith. David went up there by himself, amidst all the negative. Friend, if you're going to really face Goliath, there aren't going to be any other people that are going to face him. And they're not going to support you when you do. And they're going to preach their unbelief that keeps them from doing it to you. 5 smooth stones represent 5 accurate stones. 5 is the number of grace. These are stones that have rubbed together in the brook and have rubbed off all their sharp edges so that they'll sail and they won't catch the wind in a certain way and be caught off course. You know, when you throw rocks that are flat or have an edge, they'll curve. If you know anything about throwing rocks. These represent Christ, the stone that has been shaped by God in God's furnace, in God's stream bed. Christ was true, a true stone, straight into the headship of Satan. This whole scene is just Christ and Satan, Christ bruising Satan's head, beheading him at the cross, and Satan disdaining Christ as being weak, Christ not relying on fleshly means in any way, but totally trusting the Spirit of the Lord. It's even interesting that when Christ defeated Satan 40 days and 40 nights, he used the Word of God, the five smooth stones, the five books of the Pentateuch. But all of his quotations come from Deuteronomy. He only took one of them. Goliath is trying to put fear into David's heart. Saul tried to put unbelief in David's heart. His elder brother tried to put discouragement into David's heart. Notice how the devil is using people to inflict you with certain demonic attitudes. Are there people around you afflicting you with unbelief? Afflicting you with discouragement? Afflicting you with doubt? Are dissidents afflicting you with doubt? People are always saying, well, man, at the chapel, they won't even let you talk to people. Closed society. It's like Russia. And I say, yes, I am closed-minded to everything except Genesis to Revelation. The reason I don't talk to a number of these people is because I go by the scripture, whatsoever is true, whatsoever is of good report. Think on these things. I don't need bad reports. I don't need negative testimony. I don't need testimonies of failure and unbelief. It's not that I'm trying to close myself off from truth and like Russia, block out all kinds of information. I'm trying to close myself off from lies. I don't need those things. I do get a good share of talking to all these people, but if it's just going to be negative and I'm not going to have any influence on that person for the Lord, then I don't have any time to talk with them. In my opinion, David would have done well not to even talk to his brother or Saul. They didn't have anything from God to tell him. They didn't have anything negative, anything positive. They didn't help him any. And it's not just one, it's three. There's a number of ways that the devil is trying to get you from doing what God wants. Nothing like discouragement, nothing like unbelief, nothing like fear to hold you back. Those are powerful weapons from Satan. Do you really want your flesh to be eaten by the fowls of the air and the beasts of the field? This will put fear into you. And you're right down there facing Goliath, demonized man, full of hatred, mockery. Goliath mocked David. Look at yourself in the flesh, man. Think on a carnal level. Look at the odds. Get a good look at your circumstances. You haven't got a chance. See, this is the devil working against you. The miracle is that Peter ever got out of the boat onto that water. That's the miracle, with all the negative there was against it. He must have completely lost his head. Verse 45. David said to the Philistine, now notice David. To Eliab he said, is there not a cause? To Saul he said, his testimony of God's deliverance. And positive, verse 36. And to Goliath he says, thou comest to me with a sword and a spear and with a shield. You come to me in the natural. I come to thee in the name of Yahweh, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied. To Goliath, David preaches truth in a sermon. This day will the Lord deliver thee into mine hand, and I will smite thee and take thine head from thee. I will give the carcasses of the host of the Philistines this day unto the fowls of the air, and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And all this assembly shall know that the Lord saveth not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. That's the lesson, verse 47. And Christ won the battle on that truth. It wasn't clever intelligence. It wasn't worldly strength. It wasn't doctor's degrees. It wasn't reputation. If you think those, God's going to strip us of all those things. And the devil gets done with us, we won't have him either. Formal training. What has it done to the demon power in this city, this world, you know? What has the formal training done? I'm not against training. Call it formal training. In my opinion, you're getting formal training. This is like when my dad, when I came to Bible college, well, that went over like a lead balloon. My dad was quite concerned. So he scheduled an appointment with the pastor. He came up here and had his talk. Never were there two more opposite men talking in one room. In fact, I remember we went on vacation one time, and if you can believe this, Don and Barbara and my parents got together in my parents' condominium and spent the night. And in the evening, my wife and I were in utter stitches watching my dad and Don talk. Don was talking about Bible manuscripts. My dad didn't even know what a Bible manuscript was. He decided to pick, you know, a more mundane topic to try to, you know, witness to him and communicate with him. And my dad was talking about going to Las Vegas and seeing Roger Miller. And Don said, "Who's Roger Miller?" And my dad couldn't believe that you didn't know Roger Miller. Well, that's about how far they got. But my dad came up. And then after 1 year, my dad felt like, well, you've got enough religion now. You need to get back into your, quote, formal training or whatever. I mean, you've got to get a job. I mean, you've got to get a career. I mean, so he's looking out for my best interest from his perspective, from Saul's perspective. And so he comes back up and he talks to Don and he says, you know, this is 1 year is enough now, and, you know, Lanny really needs to go to college. And Don says, "This is college." He says, "Well, I mean a real college." He says, "Well, this is a real college." Now, you know, the pastor's taking a lot of flack, you know, people despising him. They don't even think this is a real college, you know. I mean, he's been belittled, and, you know, podunk, and have to put up with all of that, and walk by faith in the Lord and trust. You know, after a while, that, you know, 18 years of that, it's a wonder he doesn't have some bad attitudes and some demons on him. But, you know, you have to walk in the Lord. So my dad says, "Well, one where you can get a degree." He says, "Well, we do offer a degree here." And my dad says, "Well, a real degree." He says, "Well, this is a real degree." He says, "Well, I mean a degree where you can get a job." And Don says, "Well, you can get a job with a real degree here." He says, "Well, I mean a real job." And the pastor says, "Well, the ministry is a real job." And they went round and around and around and around. And I was in the middle of this, and I had to listen to this, and then I had to make a choice. And it was a showdown. And I had to choose. And I knew it was going to happen. See, I had already made the choice. There wasn't any choice to be made. I knew that there was only one thing for me, and that was what God had. And I wasn't making any decisions until I got through this Bible college. I mean, I was going all the way. And when I was done with my 4 years, I'd take a look and see what God was doing in my life and see what I wanted to do from there. But he was doing so many good things, I just kept right on going. But, and it was really hard, because my dad felt like, well, you know, you're going to do what I want you to do and all this kind of thing. And I mean, talk about the total rejection. My dad, just by that decision, which I'd already made, my dad, all he stood for, his whole life, everything he believed, was totally rejected by me. Now, lots of sons have done that. You know, your dad's a doctor, he wants you to be a doctor, and then you go off and you're a beatnik or something. You know, dad's a lawyer, and he's bringing you up to take over a position in the law firm, and you run off and you're a milkman, or you don't want to do that, or you want to be a football player or something, you know. I mean, very few sons come up into dad's business and go dad's way. They really want to do something else, and even the pressure of it. And, boy... There are hurts to this day from that. Hurts to this day. And they just, you know, I can't do anything about it because I have rejected them, hurt them, repudiated all, you know, all that they've given me and trained me and prepared me for life and all that. I've spit in their face and repudiated it all. And it's rough. It's rough to have to go through that. And I saw it. I knew that was the showdown was coming. And, then after 4 years, it was back for another appointment. Well, now the U awaits you. And it's not too late to get your college education and all that. And I had my college education. And see, here's the thing. You know, I don't want to totally down public education. There's a lot of positives for that. And my brother, you know, he's got his degrees. You know, they can get their bragging glory out of him. Manifest their pride with their friends from his occupation and everything. He's doing well. But spiritually, he's doing terrible. And he knows it. But financially, you know, he's got it. But, what was I going to say here? Public education. My dad sent me this thing recently. High school graduate in the course of his life will make $500,070 or something. Pretty close. I can remember these. A college graduate will make $1.3 million in the course of his life, and those with higher degrees make, you know, upwards and so forth. You know, that's supposed to prove to me I should be a college graduate. But I figured out how much it costs to go to college nowadays, $4,000 to $8,000 a year. 4 years is $16,000 to $32,000. You take that and invest it for the next 30 years, it'll reach $1 million. I don't think you're getting that good of a return out of a college education. Besides that, when I worked at Budget Rent-A-Car, all the guys there had college degrees. And they were parking cars. One guy had 8 years of college, 2 degrees. Parking cars. What good is a degree in psychology? You know, you go through college and you take all these wimpy courses. Just wimpy courses. They don't teach you a thing. You learn a bunch of junk that's probably... not even true, and you get a 4-year degree, and so what does it prepare you for? You can go pump gas. I mean, that's all you can do with those degrees. I remember I was an apartment manager, and there was this guy there. He was always having trouble paying the rent, and he was trying to get a job, and I gave out his phone number, and he was a minority, and he was having trouble getting a job. I was getting 3 to 5 calls a day of people asking to hire him. And, because he was a minority, and back then, they were pressuring to hire minorities, and they wanted to hire him. And so I said to him, I said, well, why didn't you take that job? And he goes, I don't wear a tie. And I go, oh, okay. You know, and I said, and I wondered why he even applied for it. And then they said, why didn't you take that job? And he says, I don't do manual labor. And I said, well, you know, if you don't wear a tie and you don't do manual labor, I'm not sure what's in between. But anyway... And then he needed a math class to get his 4-year degree, and he was taking it over here at Highline. He was short 1 credit, and he had a degree from, he was getting his degree, he was coming out of California. This math class, I'm not kidding you, this math class with 8th grade math, he could not do it. But if he could do it, with my help, he would get his 4-year degree. I don't have a lot of respect for those degrees that they offer these days, because I learned that math when I was in 8th grade. Plus I had another 4 years of math after that, in high school, much less college. But, you know, I don't have a lot of respect for those college degrees. You have a lot of money into it, and unless you go on to higher education, graduate work, it doesn't open a lot of doors for you. It just really doesn't. Not the way it is today. And so to put, and I'm not ridiculing that, and anybody, and I know a brother in this church that's, you know, going to the U full time, and he's got his sights on a certain thing. Hey, I encourage it. If you've got a vision, if you've got a goal, if you've got something, your sights on something, hey, I encourage that, if that's what you want to do. His parents are supporting him in it. It's just as good as working at a regular job. You're doing that, and you're living. So, it's good. And it depends on your aptitude, depends on your talents. If you really are talented in that area, then there's some things that can be done. You've got some opportunities. But college degree in and of itself doesn't mean a whole lot. And as far as getting respect in this world, my dad's giving me that all the time, you know. I need to have respect in this world. I don't need respect in this world. And I don't want to despise it. And those that have respect in this world, they have opportunities. See, they do have opportunities. See, God can save their soul. You know, there are people out here with a ton of degrees. God can save them and anoint them, and they can go do that ministry. I don't feel that I'm called to do that. Well, if you knew such and such, such and such, think of how God can use you. Yes, but there are lots of people that know such and such, such and such. And if God wants that ministry fulfilled, He can call them. So He can call them. But me, I know things they don't know. And I'm in a position they'll never be in. And I've got to fulfill what I'm doing. And I have knowledge of all kinds of eccentric things they'll never even dream exist. And it all adds together, in my case, and puts me in a unique position. David overcame Goliath in the name of the Lord. Verse 48. Came to pass when the Philistine arose and came into Nai to meet David, that David hasted and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. David put his hand in his bag, took thence a stone, and slang it, and smote the Philistine in his forehead, and the stone sunk into his forehead, and he fell upon his face to the earth. Now let me add one more P.S. to what I was just on. I am not against people getting good jobs. There are people that have worked for very low wages just to get through Bible college, because when you're going to Bible college full-time, obviously, I don't work on Sundays, I don't work Friday nights, and I only work afternoons. Obviously, the job market isn't really all that, you know, you're pretty thin on the job market. But you graduate from Bible college, and you're married, and you're working full-time, and you can work days or really any shift. I think you should diligently keep applying, while you're working, and continue until you get a really good job, one that will really pay you. I think you should keep applying until you get it. And set your sights on things. I have always been able to make money in the summers, but that's because I pushed my way into jobs that had money. And I remember I was talking to one brother. He was working at a lead refinery downtown, making $5.50 an hour. And I was trying to motivate him to get a better job, because he could. So he didn't need to stay there forever. There are a lot of jobs he could apply for. He should have spent at least some overtime on applications, working at other jobs. If you will keep applying, you're bound to get a job, a good job, a union job, or one of these other ones. You're bound to get it sooner or later. It's just a matter of being there. I used to go down to the longshoring yard and get on there. Total flunkies out of nowhere and make $12.15 an hour. Just picking up. Didn't even belong to the union. But they'd run short. You know what the guy would do that I was with? He always read the paper, shipping. There's a little column, shipping. What ships are in, the port. When he knew new ships were in the port, container ships, he knew the longshoring hall would run dry. He'd go down there, and they'd take anybody that's down there. And they'd just put you on a temporary thing, even if you're not even a member of the union. In fact, you can't even get in that union. The thing's locked. practically. But that didn't matter. He'd get on. Sometimes they'd send him down to Tacoma. So he'd drive down to Tacoma, work down there. I mean, there's a lot. I mean, people that are, you know, using their heads, and that was a good job. And they'd work overtime. They'd work weekends. There were days when he was making $30 an hour. Because it was a union job. If you work weekends, overtime, and hazard pay, if you're working down in the hold, it was hazard pay. I mean, unions, they give you the money. He didn't always get that, but he would go for weekends, see? Because if he worked one weekend, that was 2 weeks' wages at another job. There's a lot of opportunities, and I encourage people to get into these type of things and not just stick where you are. It's one thing to sacrifice for Bible college. It's another thing, when you're through, to get a job. I know another brother who got a job. He wanted to get a job at a particular company. So he went down there, and he went around to the back and he said, "What is the name of the man that hires, the hiring agent?" This is a large company. They said his name is, you know, so-and-so. So you don't go in the front door and ask for an application. So he went in the front door and he said, "Is so-and-so in?" to the secretary. You didn't give it back to the secretary. He says, "Is so-and-so in?" Well, now he knows his name. "Is so-and-so in? I'm here to see so-and-so." Secretary, you know, calls him up, you know, and, "Who are you?" He says, "Tell him so-and-so is here to see him." Gives him his name. And the guy thinks, "I don't even know who that is, but it must be somebody." And so the hiring agent thinks it's somebody that he should know. He's kind of embarrassed. So he gets an interview with him face to face. He would have never got that interview. So then he goes in there and he goes, "I'm here to work. I want a job with your company." And the guy goes, "Some of these people," he says, "well, have the secretary give you an application and fill it out." But now this hiring agent has met him face to face and knows his name. That's a big plus. That was the whole point of that. Fills out the application, you know, goes in the bottom drawer. I was working at a job one time, and they needed to hire a guy. He had a stack of applications this high that they'd been collecting for I don't know how many months. He was throwing them like this, reading them. He didn't even know who to hire. He finally took the whole wad and threw it in the garbage can. He turned to a friend of mine. He says, "Do you know anybody that wants to work here?" And Paul Yokers. And Paul says, "Yeah. My roommate's out in the car. It was me." I went to work on the spot. I started work that moment. It was a good job. And I was just starting to think about getting a part-time job. So I got one just like that. I mean, that's how these places hire a lot of times. You fill out an application, you need to pester them until they're so tired of having you around, they hire you. So anyway, he went down there every day, said, "Tell so-and-so, so-and-so's here for his job." And, you know, "Come back in a week. Come back in 2 weeks." He went down there every day. Within a month, he was on. And, you know, I mean, it's like they knew the guy wanted a job. And if they were going to hire anybody, I mean, it was hard to hire anybody but him. I know another guy who went to work part-time during Christmas for the post office. He went down there. There's a line of about 300 people trying to get on for maybe two part-time positions or overtime positions for post office. Hires a lot of extra help, I guess, maybe more than two. And he said, he looked at that line and he goes, "Man, I'll never get in." So he goes around the back of the building, up where all the people are sorting out letters. And somebody says, "Who are you?" And he goes, "I can't find my time card." And the guy goes, "What's your name?" Gives him his name, writes in a time card, punches him in, and he was on. Now, I am not suggesting that you try that. But I'm saying that persistence pays. 3 days later, they discovered it. But in 3 days, he had learned all the zip codes in the state of Washington. Plus, he was a brainy guy anyway. And he knew how to do these kind of things. Some people could never pull that off. Other people, they live that way. That's the way they are. So they gave him a test. He passed. And they decided that, hey, we couldn't get anybody better than this guy. So he was on. But I'm just saying, be persistent. And you can get on these jobs. I remember I used to work at this job, and they always used to mistreat me because I was a Christian. And I was driving taxi. It was a fun job, and I made good money. I don't know about anybody else, but I made good money at that job. And I would work 2 days a week, and I had enough to live on for a whole week. But sometimes I got energetic, and I worked 6 days a week. And I was really in the green. But every time I'd go in there, the guy would say, "Sorry, no cars today. Can't work today." I'd go, "Well, I'll wait around and see if anything shows up." About 45 minutes later, he'd look at me and he'd go, "All right, drive this one." Nothing had happened. He had a whole bunch of stuff there. That's just the way he was. But see, I didn't give up. I knew the game that they played, and I just played along with the game. They always made fun of me, and they knew I witnessed a lot. One time I took some guy to Aberdeen, and they were all joking about it. I go, "Man, a guy had a ride with you to Aberdeen? He must have been converted by the time he got there." I had him off balance, though, all the time. Totally off balance. And I'd witness to them with a big smile, and it was funny. I could tell you so many stories about that. But persistence. David put his hand in his bag and he smote the giant in his forehead. Now I think the stone hit him right in the bridge of the nose and went right into his brain, right between the eyes. There's a weak spot there. I don't think Goliath was killed by the stone, because David beheaded him with his own sword. But I do believe he was knocked unconscious, maybe mortally wounded even. But he was knocked down and then beheaded. Now Satan was mortally wounded, as it were, on the cross. But in a sense, he's still alive. And so Jesus is still defeating him. But that first blow to the head is what got him. See, that first blow to the head. It says in Genesis, "He shall bruise thy head." And Christ in his church is continuing to behead the enemy. And he must reign until he hath put all things under his feet. All things under his feet. And so we are part of that victory. We are part of that defeat. We are part of that victory. And the church shall defeat Goliath. See, the church is going to defeat Goliath. The church is going to defeat Satan. We have not defeated Satan now. We have a measure of victory over Satan, but boy, he has a measure of dominion over us too. But we are going to defeat him. I am encouraged by the deliverances we are getting. Boy, we are getting deliverances. Things are manifesting. Man, they're manifesting. We are getting manifestations like we used to. That's because we're starting to push on the enemy. This is good. I'm excited about this. 1 Corinthians 1:29 says, "No flesh shall glory in his presence." No flesh shall glory in his presence. This is why Saul's armor is not to be used in the battle. Because then there would be a measure of glorying in the flesh. God is going to make sure it is totally by the faith and his spirit so that he will get all the glory. So if you're nothing, rejoice. It means God is everything. Verse 51. David ran, stood on the Philistine, took his sword and drew it out of the sheath and slew him, cut off his head. And when the Philistines saw their champion was dead, they surrendered like the oath. No, they fled. They fled. I want you to know there are prince spirits around here, and when we defeat those prince spirits, the underlings flee. And we can mop up, as it were, in the battle. We've got to push on these prince spirits, and they don't go easy. You know, you know what a fortress is? A fortress is a whole bunch of stones all in harmony, making one mighty wall or one mighty castle. There are demonic strongholds that are a network of demons all working together. You know, we were rebuking a demon the other day. And all of a sudden, and this happens quite often, a demon of mockery came up. All of a sudden, here we are fighting this thing, and this brother is, you know, really an intense thing, and all of a sudden he goes, demons, demons, demons. Demons, demons, demons. A demon of mockery, interfering. Usually it's a red herring to go after the demon of mockery. Usually you can't get it out right then. Sometimes you can. We stuck on the other demon and took 20 minutes. And all of a sudden the demon of mockery was back down or somewhere. And then the other demon was back up again, madder than ever. So the demon of mockery will come up to try to get you off. And then we were praying in tongues and the demon, one time we were doing that, the demon of mockery goes, chicken talk, chicken talk, chicken talk. And this time it went, jabber, 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 jabber. You know, mock, mock, mock. And it was cracking jokes and trying to make us laugh. Hey, I'll admit, it was funny. It was funny. But I wasn't about to get distracted. And we kept pressing in the name of the Lord. God give us strength. But see, there was a stronghold of demons working together, and they were all in cahoots against us, and it was tough to break through. It was tough to get one demon out when all these others were all working together. David used a sling. He didn't just go up there and command him to fall. But the sling by itself isn't enough. See, God, you got to give God something to anoint. Truth in your mind, something he can anoint. Prayers. Faith. There's got to be something he can anoint. We'll continue on here then. Next time, we'll finish this up. Be sure you read a chapter or two ahead so that you're familiar with the text.